Hi, this is PodSave the UK. I'm Nish Kumar.
And I'm Coco Khan. So, Nish, you ever accidentally ended up in a top secret military messaging group?
Who amongst us has not accidentally added a journalist to a top secret military messaging group where we're discussing plans to bomb another country? Let he who is without sin launch the first missile.
I can't say it's happened. I've been in some hen party WhatsApp groups that feel like you're in the military. Do you know what I mean? 10 a.m. Rosé, you will enjoy it. I can't say it's something I particularly relate to.
Oh, 200 hours. You will be wearing a hat shaped like a penis.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
What you're talking about is the biggest security fuck-up in the US, where a journalist was invited into a group chat where Trump officials were planning airstrikes on Yemen.
It's just mad, isn't it? And not just that, can I say, they were also slagging us off, saying that we're freeloading Europeans. Vice President JD Vance said that he hates bailing Europe out again.
And Secretary of Defence Pete Hegseth replied, "I fully share your loathing of European freeloading. It's pathetic." And pathetic was in capital letters, which I think we can all agree is really cool.
Still though, a bit of an ouch. But anyway, dusting ourselves off, on the podcast today, we're finding out what's in Rachel Reeves' spring statement, or in other words, just how fucked are we?
And we're talking about the Netflix show Adolescence and whether we need a minister for men.
Now, before we get into Rachel Reeves' spring statement, Nish, I really want to know how that leak of secret war plans is going down in the US.
Well, I'm not currently actually in America. I have, like a lot of people have threatened to do, I have fled north of the border to Canada. But it's not part of any fleeing plans for me. It's part of a pre-agreed and pre-booked tour schedule. But I was in the States when the story broke. Obviously, I am speaking to a very specific demographic of Americans, but they are obviously horrified at what's happening in their country and the things that their country is doing on a foreign policy level. But last week, that horror shifted to just pure shame. Just pure shame. And you know, it's a shame that you can absolutely relate to. When there was a period where our representative on the global stage was successively Boris Johnson and Liz Truss, we all felt the heated flush of pure embarrassment whenever we spoke to somebody not from our country. And I think last week, the main overriding emotion was deep embarrassment. And also genuine concern, because this is like a huge security breach. Mike Waltz, the National Security Advisor, has claimed full responsibility for adding the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, to the group chat on the messaging app Signal, but still can't seem to fully explain how it happened, why they aren't using the secure messaging service that exists for military communications in America is the biggest and most important question. Trump downplayed the blunder, saying there was no classified information. He later called The Atlantic, a magazine with over 2 million followers on X, a failed magazine, and Goldberg a total sleazebag. Why he didn't text Goldberg that information directly is beyond me.
I think of myself as that I'm at this point unshockable, that nothing would surprise me. But this story did surprise me. There's a lot, as you've outlined, you know, there's lots about it that's really concerning. And maybe this is the least of the worries, but it was something about the emojis that I found particularly just gross and crass. So special envoy to the Middle East, Steve Witkoff, used two prayer emojis, a flexed bicep and two American flags to react to the update about airstrikes on Yemen, in which 53 people lost their lives. So that's great, isn't it? That's classy.
We all find it quite strange when our parents use emojis. That doesn't quite feel appropriate. So if that doesn't feel appropriate, what American governmental officials using emojis to discuss the bombing of a country feels like is beyond my understanding. We should also say, from a kind of British and European perspective, the points of interest here really are, as you say, Coco, the disdain expressed for Europe. JD Vance called Europe a bunch of freeloaders, and Trump said that he agreed with that. That's good to hear. And over in the UK, the Lib Dem leader, Ed Davey, who's been an outspoken critic of Trump, has said, JD Vance and his mates clearly aren't fit to run a group chat, let alone the world's strongest military force. It has to make our security services nervous about the intelligence we're sharing with them. Yeah, fair point, Ed. Absolutely fair point.
And you would hope that you might see more criticism, but actually there's not really been that much. You know, Downing Street has been much more restrained. I completely understand they're trying to keep Donald Trump sweet. We're all very afraid of these trade tariffs. So the Prime Minister's spokesperson rejected the idea that Europe was freeloading on defence, but refused to take a pop at the Trump team, saying the UK remains happy to share intelligence with the US and just generally sort of pant around them and maybe like kiss them when they need and other such sucking up actions.
We're obviously going to go into this in much more detail in the bulk of what today's show is about, which is about Rachel Reeves-Spring's statement. But one of the things I am finding very funny is the amount, and I understand that the Labour Party is in a very difficult and complicated position here because its growth agenda is completely tied to the United States of America, and they don't want to upset a man who is historically one of the most thin-skinned. His skin is essentially gossamer. It's lighter than silk. That is the extent to which this man is thin-skinned. But it is always very funny at the moment when they keep talking about the unforeseen economic conditions and then not saying by which we mean President Trump. And the fact that he seems to have done a couple of lines before he banged out his policy that morning. It's very funny that they, on the one hand, keep going, we are absolutely 100% solidly committed to our partnership with the United States of America. And at the same time, keep saying, some weird shit is going down. Rachel Reeves is going to say, our commitment to our American relationship is ironclad, whilst they move a Trump Tower sign onto 10 Downing Street.
I read a piece in the FT this morning that was saying that leaders who stand up to Trump are enjoying a massive poll lift. And they had a picture of Starmer alongside other leaders. And there was a part of me that thought, wow, gosh, news really does move fast, doesn't it? That was my main thought when they commissioned that illustration. I was like, oh, no. Oh, no.
On to the big UK news of the week, as I alluded to somewhat clumsily there. Rachel Reeves has delivered her spring statement. Now, spring statements are not full budgets. They're not usually a big deal, but this one is. It's not a budget with loads of detailed tax and spending plans. It's more a kind of health check on the state of our economy, which Reeves has given us. And basically, it's a sort of how fucked are we on a scale of 1 to 10?
And so what we wanted to know was, would Rachel Reeves finally throw off the shackles of fiscal rules so we can dance, you know, like, would she surprise us? Would we get some happy news?
Yeah, we were hoping for taxation on the rich, magic money trees galore and a commitment to pacifism.
But let's find out. So here she is addressing Parliament.
Mr. Speaker, the world is changing. We can see that and we can feel it. A changing world demands a government that is on the side of working people, acting in their interest, acting in the national interest. Not retreating from challenges, not stepping back, but a government with the courage to step up, to secure Britain's future, and to seize the opportunities that are out there before us. I am impatient for change. The British people are impatient for change after 14 years of failure. And we are beginning to see change happen. Our plan for change is working. Defence spending is rising. Waiting lists are falling. Wages are up. Interest rates are cut. That is the difference that this Labour government is making.
So joining us to unpack Reeves' statement and what it means for the UK is economist James Medway. James was the former advisor to Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell and the director of the Progressive Economy Forum. He's been an important critic of austerity economics and at the forefront of efforts to imagine alternatives. James, welcome to PodSafe the UK.
Well, thank you for having me and thanks for the invite on.
So what did you make of the speech then?
Well, I mean, look, if people have watched it, Rachel Reeves is not noted for a sort of levity of delivery. And this was, even by the standards that she set in the last few years, was not not exactly a, an upbeat message. I mean, the central part of it people know about, which is this almost, not quite, £5 billion of cuts to social security, particularly for those receiving money for disabilities that they have, which is, actually, we'll come back to this. For government, it's not really very much, but for individuals, it's a huge amount. You're talking for 800,000 recipients of personal independence payments, which is money you get to basically help you live a more usual life, so you can go about your life and be integrated what everyone else is doing and not have to suffer too much. I mean, it's still frankly not enough. Average loss there is about £4,000 for people. So it's really like a huge amount of money that is being taken away from some people who really actually need that money. I mean, this is the sort of cruelty that's involved here. On the government's own figures, the scale of cuts means that by 2030, the government's own figures say there'll be 250,000 more people in poverty, of which 50,000 are children by the end of this decade. So this is grim. I'd assume that this isn't the message she ever wanted to deliver, but to a significant extent, it is also kind of her own fault. There's a lot of chat about, oh, the world's changed and everything's different, and now we have to spend a load of money on the Ministry of Defence and the Army and all the rest of it, and everything's, you know, been shaken up. And it's like, that is true to some extent, but it is still your choice to do this. There are always other options if you're the government, particularly if the government are a big, actually rich country like Britain. You can choose to do things that aren't driving some of the most desperate people in the country further into poverty.
Because when you heard the speech there, she talked about, you know, the British people have had enough, and it made it sound like she was going to announce some sort of change of record, really. Just for complete Luddites like me, how George Osborne is
this? It's pretty George Osborne. When you think about what Osborne did when he turned up as Chancellor in, God, I think, a horribly long time ago, 2010, when the coalition government got into office. And immediately Osborne did something that Rachel Reeves should have done but didn't, which was sort of hit the ground running, do his emergency budget in June that year and say straight away there are going to be big cuts, particularly to social security, to benefits, and that's what we're going to go for. And they really jammed that through over the next few years. Now, the figures around that are pretty horrifying. You can see the enormous increase in food bank use, you know, over the last 15 years or so as those cuts have played out. I mean, it's really brutal when a government which offers support, even if it's, let's be honest, mostly not great, then takes it away, right? People suffer very directly as a result of this. So in terms of how it compares to George Osborne, this is very, very similar. The difference is something slightly more technical, maybe, but that is Rachel Reeves also announced an increase in capital investment spending, which I think Labour are going to try and talk up. In other words, they say that there's £2 billion more to spend on the big stuff that government might build. In this case, I think they're going to go for various parts of the sort of energy system, energy infrastructure, and a few other things. So she's actually increased that part of government spending a little bit. Again, probably not by really enough to make noticeable differences.
And we should also say that these benefit cuts are actually more severe than they'd been trailed. I think the hope was that the disquiet caused by the announcement would at least limit it to just being those cuts, or hopefully actually scale back some of the nature of some of these cuts. The welfare cuts, the further welfare cuts than they had previously been trailed, amount to about £500 million because the cuts that they initially projected weren't going to make the £5 billion worth of savings that they wanted. So Reeves has added these cuts today. The universal credit health elements will be cut to new claimants by around 50% and then frozen. And as you say, the figures that you're talking about come from the Department for Work and Pensions, whose own estimate provided the figures that you've quoted. 3 million families worse off by 2030, amounting to an average loss of £1,720 per year. This has gone hand in hand with the prominence of defence and defence spending. She wants to turn the UK, Rachel Reeves says, into a defence industrial superpower, and confirmed £2.2 billion of money for defence, which, as we know, is being paid for by reducing the aid budget. She mentioned places that will benefit, like Barrow, Plymouth and Portsmouth. They've confirmed that a £2 billion investment in social and affordable housing is going to happen. And one good bit of news for the government was that the OBR calculated that planning reforms make Labour's target of 1.5 million homes in the UK over the next 5 years plausible. James, I definitely want to talk to you about alternatives that could be projected, but just sticking with what we actually have in front of us, what's the political argument for this?
if the government has a line on this, and you can kind of see what they're trying to get to, it goes, and this is their argument, it goes something like, we need to fix long-term problems in the British economy, right? Which is kind of true. There's a whole stack of things that haven't worked very well, really, for a long period of time. I mean, it's a low investment, low productivity, still quite rich, but like really low growth, low wage economy. To fix that, you need investment. So their line is, okay, we have the fiscal rules that guarantees stability. Once you guarantee stability, everyone can see that this is a safe place to invest. Businesses come in, government supports them a little bit. In 4, 5, 6 years' time, everything looks better because we have loads of growth. And that's when we can start spending. The basic problem here is look, this sort of doesn't really add up. Like, if you start thinking about, okay, what is a plausible amount of growth that they can get? The OBR says growth this year, it thinks, is going to fall by about half. In other words, the rate of growth is down by about half, to about 1% from what they said last year. And then growth in the next few years picks up a bit to about 1.8%. Now, 1.8% historically is not very much growth. Like other big, rich, developed economies, Britain is growing slower than it has done in the past. I mean, this is sort of a universal rule. So if you go back to the 60s, you have 4% growth a year. But at 1.8% growth, that doesn't give you the taxes coming back in to pay for all the stuff you said you're going to do. Like, it just wasn't plausible to sit there before the election and know that people were voting Labour expecting a difference to be made to the NHS, to schools, to actually to the social security system, to a whole stack of things that people anticipate a Labour government's going to do and try and fix. That's why people vote Labour. I mean, New Labour, Tony Blair and Gordon Brown understood this. That's why they went out and spent more money, back in the 2000s. And there's some sort of messing around with the figures here. The OBR projection, the one that Rachel Reeves was talking about, the OBR is the Office of Budget Responsibility, the official forecasters. They were saying that, okay, households on average will be £500 better off a year by 2029. Now, that number is already quite shakily dependent on the growth that they think will happen actually happening. But what we know about the Office of Budget Responsibility is that since it was set up 15 years ago, it consistently is too optimistic. So if it gives you a growth number, it is consistently underneath that. Now, there's a long-term problem there that the OBR kind of misses, but they always do this. If that growth doesn't come in, that £500 you're supposed to have more by 2029 disappears. So it's not just that, okay, this is bad for like some of the most desperate and most vulnerable people out there. It's immediately bad for them. It doesn't look great for anybody else because everything is dependent on what is not a very high rate of growth actually being delivered. And past experience suggests that that isn't even going to happen. You don't get much growth when you don't have a government spending money. It's quite simple. The government needs to put money into the economy in order that people have money to spend in order to encourage growth. If you're doing cuts, that process doesn't happen.
In terms of people's lived experience, is any of this going to be an improvement? So, you talked about the capital investment that Labour have said that they're going to, put more into. That's meant to go straight into housing. Housing is something that we all feel very, very acutely on our everyday lives. The one bit of news from the OBR is that the 1.5 million homes target is plausible. Surely that is a lot of people who will be feeling that their lives have improved. Going back to the defence spending, and we can talk about the rights of wrongs on that shortly. But for people in places like Plymouth and Barrow and Portsmouth, won't their lives improve? Will anyone's lives be improved, do you think?
The challenge on the what the OBR is saying is that, okay, it says, look, we think it's plausible. And it's like, all right, well, I think we have to take that with a pinch of salt. The number of houses that they say are going to get built by the private sector in this country is way, way above what the private house builders managed in decades. I mean, frankly, close to ever has that been done. If you want more houses built historically in Britain, this has been the case over the last 70 years or so, it's government who has to build them, right? That's when you have this peak of house building in Britain. You get a massive expansion of council housing coming out of the 40s, 50s, 60s into the 70s, and then it drops off entirely. And that's where you don't get many houses built. Now, if the OBR is then saying, okay, there's going to be a sudden rush of private house building, this is kind of unprecedented. This hasn't happened before. And they're expecting it to happen without the government commitment there of money, investment, also building houses to make it happen. So it doesn't look great. It doesn't mean it won't happen. It's just like, this is kind of a stretch. Like, we have to have a lot of faith in the OBR forecasting powers, which have not been great, and a lot of faith in house builders, profit-seeking private house builders who haven't built very many houses in Britain for a long period of time, turning around and going, whoopee-doo, it's all good now, off we go. The planning system's been reformed, we've got loads of money. It's stretching credibility to think that this is going to be delivered under these circumstances. The cost of living crisis hasn't ended. Like, stuff is still really expensive, and things that people really rely on having to buy all the time, food, energy, water, these are the things going up. So that squeeze is still there. There's not very much in this announcement that's going to address this. And I say not very much, close to zero, really.
I was just going to say, a lot of politicians this week have got themselves in a bit of a twist about whether this is going to be austerity 2.0 or not. But that doesn't really matter, does it, James? I mean, if you're leading with £5 billion worth of cuts, whether you call it austerity or not, people are going to think of it as austerity.
Exactly. If you're saying that you've got 250,000 people going to poverty as a result of your decisions to cut benefits spending, that is austerity. That is the austerity that people feel. That is not having the lives that most of us are leading looking much better at this point in time. This is the other problem we're talking about, growth. It's like, it's nice to get it, but it's a long-term process, right? So even if the government really pushes on house building and stuff, yeah, you start to see houses being built, but it's a long process to turn things around. And if you start saying, as the government, growth is the key to this, then politically, you've got a problem if you don't deliver it in only 4 years' time.
Earlier, you outlined what the Labour government would be saying, and the first thing you said was like, they will say the fiscal rules are important because it shows that we're a stable country to do business. Do you agree with that?
It's not necessarily a bad thing for you as a government to lay out and say clearly, so that everybody knows, you know, whether you're like some bond trader, whether you're like looking to buy a house or whatever you might be doing, everybody knows what it expects to be happening in 5 years' time or 10 years' time, right? It's not a bad idea to lay that out. That's the sort of reason you might have fiscal rules of some sort. So you give everybody a sense of where the government and its borrowing and spending and all the rest is going to end up. That's not inherently a bad thing to do. The problem with Labour's particular rules is that they were written a few years ago, in a time when interest rates were lower, inflation was lower, and actually suddenly you've got a lot of room. You can borrow a lot because it's dead cheap if interest rates are low through the government. You've got loads of room inside your fiscal rules. And as interest rates have gone up and as inflation's gone up across the world, I mean, Britain isn't alone in all of this, then suddenly your space inside your own rules is shrunk. And that's kind of the problem that Rachel Reeves keeps bumping up against. This is why, you know, we've had this business today of saying we're going to have to significantly cut benefits spending. You do have the option of saying, okay, the world has changed. We need to change the rules. Like, they could have done that. And you might start to say, in addition, hey, we're also going to ask some of the very wealthy people in this country to pay a bit more into all this. That's actually quite a credible place to get to. It makes sense. The sums add up. You can see what's going on. So that's Rachel Reeves' problem, is that she's fixed herself to these specific rules that are really tight now, that are really difficult to meet. And if you're going to insist on meeting them, and you're also going to say, we can't actually increase taxes on the wealthy, for instance, then you're going to fail like this every time and go and look for other, frankly, victims of your economic policy. And that's what we've seen happening today.
Even the Institute of Fiscal Studies has said that a slavish adherence to a fiscal target is not sensible. You know, this is not exactly a like bastion of leftist political thought. Even they're saying that these rules, it's not sensible. What would have happened if she relaxed her fiscal rules?
It depends how it's done, I suppose. I mean, why didn't they think through? Because again, we had a year really of opinion polls saying Donald Trump's going to win. Why wasn't there a contingency plan for what happens when he wins and there's a certain amount of chaos introduced into the world, right? That's their big reasoning behind all of this. Chaos in the world, growth targets had changed, need to spend more on defense. Okay, why wasn't there a plan to do that? If they'd had a plan, they could have gone into government and says, the world has changed, we're going to change our rules. They could have done that. They could have done that straight away. That'd be a serious, credible thing to do. Everybody would understand it and they'd be in a better position now. I think there's a couple of things in that. One of them is, it's a sort of genuine fear, but you can manage it, which is that they think that if they change the rules, this will be treated by financial markets as the government is now no longer credible in its promises, and this will spark off a kind of Liz Truss-style meltdown, and that would definitely be bad. Mm-hmm. And that would definitely be bad. But if you tell everyone well in advance you want to make this change, then you can just do it. What happened in Germany, right? You can act like this if you want. There are more constraints in Britain. The economy's in a worse place in many ways, but you still have a lot of room for manoeuvre there. Instead, they've stuck to these things doggedly. The only way it really starts to make sense in its own terms is if you have a very sincere belief, and I have to assume that Rachel Reeves does believe something like that, and the Treasury believes something like that, that above all else, financial stability from the government is what matters. And if you get that right, everything else will fall into place. But really, if your financial stability is only there on the back of you doing big cuts and you actually introducing serious instability into people's lives and leaving the economy exposed, because that's what's happening now, exposed to what happens in the rest of the world, because there isn't that basic security about government spending and investment because it's not enough, then you're not doing financial stability at all. You're just kind of exposing the whole economy to wider problems in a world that's increasingly unstable.
PodSave the UK is brought to you by Sky Sports.
Coco, what are you most excited about this F1 season?
I mean, truthfully, I'm most excited to watch my other half just crumble at the raw emotions. He's a Lewis Hamilton super fan. I don't know if I've told you before. And the Lewis Hamilton story right now is probably at its most exciting. He's moving to Ferrari.
Yes, that's right. After over a decade with Mercedes, Hamilton is taking on the biggest challenge of his career, driving for the most legendary team in F1 history. Can he bring Ferrari back to the top, or will the pressure of the prancing horse prove too much? F1 isn't just about speed. It's about the live experience and the raw emotions that Coco Khan's partner goes through of seeing the drivers come alive.
The ecstasy, the agony. No, it's going to be really, really exciting. So from Monaco's tight corners to the high-speed chaos of Silverstone, every race is a battle. It's not just against the clock, but against the competition, the strategy, the nerves. You know, a lot of these races have long rivalries at the heart of them. I am told that Max Verstappen is a baddie. So anyway, let's find out. So with Sky Sports F1, you're not just watching, you're inside the action live. So don't miss a single moment.
Search Get Sky Sports F1 for details. Go to sky.com/TV/sports to upgrade to Sky Sports F1. That's sky.com/TV/sports to upgrade to Sky Sports F1.
Could you do instead of austerity? Is there another way? Because honestly, for my adult life, it seems like it's always been austerity, and we can rebrand it in different ways, but you're consistently told that this is the only way. So what are some other ways?
I think you're absolutely right, because it is 15 years now. There have been points where austerity has slowed down and governments have spent a bit more. This has happened. Rachel Reeves' first budget, she did spend more. So we've kind of seen bits of what might be different. The bit that I think we could do now, and the bit that seems most obvious for an economy in Britain's kind of somewhat shaky position, we import a lot from the rest of the world. Government debt is quite high. There is an exposure to what people in financial markets think about us that's probably worse than other similar economies around the world. But what we also have is a lot of inequality. And that means there's, you know, quite a few people up at the top end of society with a great deal of wealth, which we could start to think about taxing properly and putting that wealth to use. And that would provide the basis for going out and making spending decisions. And that would be how you start to end austerity. And that once you start to think about, okay, we're ending austerity in a serious way, we're going to think about the real economy, the places where people actually live, the day-to-day lives we lead, get these questions right. You know, get the high streets that we have to walk down every day that are not just full of closed shops and maybe, you know, betting shops and the chicken shop, if you're lucky, that sort of thing. Get actual investment going in there. Start to spend money in the day-to-day lives people lead. Start to make the economy people live in work. That has to be the basis then for everything else you want to do. And that has to start to look like spending going into, for instance, local authorities, who they now have, after 60% cuts over the last 15 years or so, would now have a bit more money to make towns and cities up and down the country look a bit better, start to work a bit better. Get those building blocks correct, right? And do it in the first instance by saying, we are finally going to do something about soaring rates of inequality in this country. So whether it's a wealth tax, whether it's increasing capital gains tax, so it's the same as income tax, whether it's closing some of the more obvious loopholes that very, very wealthy people use to sneak around some of the tax that we do have, whatever combination it is, that's what you start to do instead. That would be your starting point, I think.
What does a wealth tax actually look like? I mean, is there also an opportunity maybe not to have a wealth tax, and maybe one of the two things that you've alluded to that's left in the British high street, apart from chicken shops, which I will accept no slander against, justice for Morley's, but the betting shops that exist in the high street, is there maybe a more specific and targeted taxation we could execute on the gambling industry? And what also specifically does a wealth tax look
almost like? Certainly, right? You can think of things that are significantly undertaxed in various different ways scattered throughout the economy. I mean, one of them that's quite striking that we did start to do something on, but it's now fallen into this sort of discussion with the Donald Trump administration, is a digital services tax, which is a tiny, it's like 2% of revenues that the big US tech companies generate here. So, you know, Facebook and whoever make a lot of money in this country, that money basically disappears back to the US in the form of profits for Facebook and the rest of them. The previous government introduced a very small tax on some of those sales. Brings in about $700 million a year, right? Now, you could increase that tax. You could say, maybe we want a bit more. The discussion that the government is having with Donald Trump and his administration right now is about scrapping that as a kind of sweetener for a deal, a trade deal. So at every point, there are decisions being made that kind of work in the wrong direction, all this. In the case of the proposal doing the rounds in Britain, the one that's gaining a bit of momentum, people like Gary Stevenson are talking about, is saying, okay, it'll be an annual tax, 2% on any wealth you have that's been assessed over £10 million, right? Which is a tiny fraction of people right at the top of society. It's actually quite a small part of their wealth. And you say every year you pay your 2% and that's just the extra bit of tax you're going to pay for being really incredibly wealthy. And I think there's a solid argument for saying you can do something like that, raise in this case £24 billion. If you didn't want to go that big, if you thought this is going to be a big old change, you could start to think about equalizing capital gains tax. In other words, the tax you're supposed to pay if you sell some shares or sell an antique. You know, this is a capital gain you make if you make a profit out of it. At the minute, that tax is lower than the tax you pay if you go to work and earn money, right? Which is weirdly unfair, right? It's just an obscure, slightly odd thing that's happened in the tax system. Close that gap, you get at least £12 billion extra in a year, right? So there are things that can be done if you have a government with a bit of backbone, a bit of political willingness to go out and make some of these things happen.
The politics of it is really fascinating because, as I understand it, all the polling is saying that wealth taxes would be quite popular. Do you think this could be a tipping point? Do you think this statement here is enough to make other Labour politicians, Labour members, even just the general public say, right, that's it, you lot have lost the plot?
I think so. I mean, this is sort of the politics of it, but it feels like that. We haven't had a Labour government like this before that's acted like this. I mean, think about New Labour. You know, people sort of criticise Gordon Brown and Tony Blair for a whole stack of things, Iraq war being the most obvious one, of course. But if you look at what they did domestically, like Gordon Brown, after a couple of years of, you know, sticking to Tory spending limits, really started to spend money on the NHS, on education, opening Sure Start centres, improving people's benefits if they were in work. There's a whole stack of things that New Labour did at the time. That's partly why there's a bunch of people who look back at it now with some affection. And they're not completely delusional about this. This is what Labour governments do. They spend more money on the things that people who vote Labour want to see them spend money on. So to have them turn around and basically say, okay, actually, one budget push and then everything else is austerity from here on inwards. That's what we're getting with Rachel Reeves. This is weirdly unusual, right? This is way out of line with what Labour does. And that's going to start to niggle, I think, in Labour MPs' heads, Labour members' heads, certainly Labour voters' heads. I mean, the polling for this government now is pretty shocking if you look at what they're on relative to reform, for instance. But in Labour MPs' heads, I think this is going to rattle around. They didn't go into politics, so you can sit there and go, like, do you know what? What did we achieve? 250,000 more people in poverty. That's not what you're going to do if you're a Labour MP. So I think there's going to be a lot of pressure building up in parliamentary terms about that. But I think everybody else can see the problem beyond that, which is that you are doing these things whilst allowing, for example, some of the biggest, richest companies on the planet, you're handing a massive tax cut. That's what's being proposed at the minute. You're not going off and taxing wealth. You're actually reducing taxes on wealth. You're making it easier for the super rich. So I think that's going to really start to gel with people. That kind of basic argument of fairness is one everyone can see pretty rapidly.
I wanted to ask you, James, because, you know, everything Labour's saying is about one day we're going to achieve growth. I don't know. Listen, I'm a high consumer of Instagram wellness content, you know, growth, personal growth, spiritual growth, you know, growth. I don't know if they're on the same platforms as me, maybe. But, you know, growth is good. I get it. We all get it. But I've previously heard you say that, like, this pursuit of growth is just, it's ridiculous because we kind of are at the most growiest we can be. I don't think that's a word. It's a bit Donald Trump there, isn't it? Bigly growiest. We've exhausted lots of things. And really what we should be doing is saying, oh, how do we make what we have? How do we make that fairer? And I was thinking to myself about that. And I thought, oh God, there's something about that that's quite bleak, because it makes it sound like this is the best Britain can ever be. And I think a lot of people will say, well, this is rubbish. And I was curious, but how do you reconcile those two things, where you believe that growth is not the right goal, but also you have hope for a better country?
Well, because you got to say, like, growth, what for? I mean, this seems to be the question that the government don't really answer. And who's going to get the benefits from it and how? Right, we need a slightly more sophisticated conversation about what kind of economy and society we want to live in. Like, what do we actually value here? What do we want to work? Do we want people who are elderly or sick or needing hospital treatment to be looked after? Do we want schools that, you know, we aren't seeing kids once again going to porter cabins that are falling apart? Do we want these things to happen? Yes, we do. So then how do we design an economy that delivers that is where you start from. And growth can come into this, but you can't just start with growth and say, right, the thing to get is growth, and then we'll somehow cascade this into everything else that happens, because there is a problem here.
Because they would say they don't have the money in the economy to do that, to build that Britain, so they have to go for growth.
But we do have, I mean, this is the two issues here. One of them is that growth is slow. If you have to fix a load of things quickly, you're saying, okay, we're going to get growth, fine. We can come back onto like how much growth we're actually going to get in the future. Okay, we're going to get growth in the future, but it's in the future. Right? There are school roofs falling apart right now. The NHS is creaking right now. You need to deliver the resources this right now. So that's either the government borrows, or you go and tax, or you do some combination of both. And that needs to happen now. And that's where you start from. Because the other bit is this, the bit that's slightly mad in some ways, is if you go, okay, look, we have a society that's more elderly than it was. It's going to get more elderly into the future. It's actually a good thing, by the way. It's good that people are living longer. We should stop treating it as such a terrible burden.
Yeah. I'm really glad you said that.
It's like, oh, we've got to deal with all these pensioners. Great. Like, isn't that nice? Isn't it nice that people are living longer than we used to? And let's like start from how do we manage that? Not like, oh, this is a problem, isn't it? Maybe they should make them work until they're 80, right? Let's try and get this the right way around.
It's all got very Logan's Run, like the rhetoric it has all got a bit like, we've got this aging population who we should probably be bumping off.
Exactly. It's a bit sort of, it says something quite fundamental about a real sort of problem with framing how we think about the economy. It's something, it gets presented like this. Rachel Reeves was doing it today. It's presented as this big separate thing, like some terrible god that we have to make sacrifices to, and maybe they'll smile and deliver something to us. It's not like that at all. We produce this. The economy is what we all live in. So if you start from like, what can we do to make people's lives better on like a day-to-day noticeable basis? That's a whole bunch of things you have to do quickly. But that involves a conversation about the distribution of resources, not saying in the future we will have more resources to distribute. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. I'm also still reeling from your comment that the government's waiting for 2006 to come back. And I just kept thinking, 2006, yeah, when the Kaiser Chiefs were good. It's never going to happen, Keir. It's over. That moment's gone.
We all want it to be 2006 again. I would love to be 21 again. It's not going to happen.
Can we somehow build a time machine? That's the investment plan for the government. Get us all back there.
Listen, new rave never dies.
If I went back to the 2000 now, I'd probably be slightly horrified by a whole bunch of things.
Yeah, I mean, I see the teenagers wearing the baggy jeans again. You're getting mud all over your trousers. Not everything that happened in the early 2000s was good. You were just statistically further away from death.
Which is now slightly further away than it used to be, which is a good thing.
Well, thank you for ending this on a positive note.
Yeah, sorry, that got a bit bleak, but you know. You asked me to talk about Rachel Reeves' spring statement, and it's not great. But there are moments of hope here. Look, honestly, I think people are genuinely starting to ask the right questions about what's going on here. Like, why do we have the fiscal rules being so important? Why can't we do something about inequality? Why do we just have to accept another round after almost 15 years of austerity? Why do we have to accept this forevermore? We don't need to. Things could be different.
James Medway, thank you so much for joining us on Pod Save the UK. Now, if you're only listening to our podcast, you're missing out, because we've got full video episodes and a ton of exclusive content on YouTube.
Like the Pod Save the World and Pod Save the UK bonus episode, where Tommy Vietor, Ben Rhodes and I discuss how the Labour government is doing, the Farage-Musk drama and what Trump's America looks like from the outside.
It's a great episode. I've really enjoyed it. What was that beautiful poetic phrase you had about Nigel Farage? A boil on the state of the nation, was that it? Walking gout. Was it walking gout?
Yes, I think the phrase is, if gout was a guy. We had a really nice time talking about some pretty depressing individuals. So just hit up Pod Save the World on your nearest YouTube search bar. And don't forget to hit subscribe so you never miss a beat.
And now, listeners, have you got a question for us? That's right. We're talking about our upcoming mailbag special. We've had some great questions in already. So actually, I'm going to pull one out for you, Nish. What place in the UK do you think is the most underrated to visit?
I'll tell you where I do really have a lot of time for that I think people are surprised by is Norwich. Norwich is a great city. It's a really beautiful part of the world. It's a kind of cool, artsy place. That would be my sort of hot tip. No one's underrating Belfast. No one's underrating like Manchester. No one's underrating Glasgow. You know, those are cities that everyone knows are cool. But I would say as a real gem of a place, Norwich, big fan. Just to be clear, all the places I've named are places that I sell well on tour and have good comedy gigs at.
So this is your last chance to send in your questions, leave a comment or email us at psuk@reducelistening.co.uk and stay tuned for the episode in a couple of weeks' time.
Now, after the break, we'll be chatting about the Netflix show Adolescence, which sparked a national conversation about toxic masculinity.
So Nish, I know you've been busy on tour, but have you watched Adolescence yet?
I have not watched Adolescence yet. And I'll be honest with you, the reason I haven't is because I am touring, I'm moving around a lot. And to be quite frank with you, I need to only be consuming very easily digestible television programs or films. And I watched the first 2 minutes of the first episode of Adolescence and thought, I'm going to come back to this when I'm on a week off. Yay. I'm really excited to see it. So talk to me about it.
Yeah. So for any of our audience who don't know, Adolescence is a Netflix drama. It's created by Stephen Graham and Jack Thorne. It tells the story of a 13-year-old boy who's arrested on suspicion of murdering a girl from his schools. The creators were inspired by a couple of real life cases, and there's been quite a lot of them. I'm sorry to say. And the show raises questions about toxic masculinity and the damaging impact of the manosphere, where essentially we're talking about boys, not even men, killing girls. And the show has really struck a nerve. I think I saw a statistic that it was number one in over 70 countries. So this is, it's not just a British problem. This is not just an American problem. This is across the world. And it's really captured people. It even got the attention of the Prime Minister. So Keir Starmer said he was watching it. He was speaking to BBC Radio 5 Live on Monday. He said, as a father to teenagers, you know, he's worried about this crisis in masculinity. He's also said that, oh, he would support it being shown in schools. Got to tell you, Nish, when I heard that, I was actually quite angry. I thought, why are you on the radio acting like, oh God, I can't believe it. I'm so moved by this. You are the Prime Minister. You have the power to stop this. You have the power to do things and stop this dangerous material getting into the hands of very vulnerable young boys in a way that nobody else has. I get to be worried, not you, Mr. Starmer. But anyway, it sort of really frustrated me, actually.
Do you think that this has the potential to be another Mr. Bates versus the post office moment, which was an ITV drama that we talked about extensively on the show when it went out, which actually pushed the government to start compensating the victims of the post office scandal? Is this something that could possibly spark a kind of actual legislative response?
I mean, it definitely could, in terms of, you know, reaching the public where they are, making people feel like this is an urgent issue that needs to be tackled immediately. I have to say, I think that Mr. Bates versus the post office is quite unusual, because actually something did come of it. And for the most part, you know, you can get a brilliant drama and it raises awareness, but nothing really takes place. So I kind of hope it does do that. But on the other hand, I also think this is not how this should work. It shouldn't be governance by Netflix or governance by a TV drama. Do you know what I mean? These are issues that are based on real life things that should have been corrected anyway without needing to do this piece of work.
Yeah. But I just would say, as a side issue, this is why art and culture is important to us as a society. The arts and culture does create opportunities to have really important conversations through scripted television programs. And so when people talk about why funding for the arts is important and why it's important we support arts and culture, this is why. This is exactly why it's incredibly important that you actually have a well-funded art sector, because there are moments like this.
Because it is a work of fiction, however, it's very closely based on real life, it's already been drawn into this culture war issue where people are saying that it's been manipulated to suit a woke agenda, right? So I don't know if you've come across this, and I hope you haven't, because it's just another unbearable culture war nonsense thing. But, you know, you've got the sections of the hard right, far right, whatever you want to call it, saying that actually when you look at the cases where the perpetrator killed a young girl, they were nearly always people of colour, boys of colour. And so they said, oh, but you put a white boy in the lead character because, you know, you want to please the wokes or something like that. I mean, it's complete nonsense. There have been examples where white boys have killed white girls. And the whole point of it is saying, like, this is a universal problem, and kids from supposedly good families can be caught up on it. And it's the ability to portray it in the television, to humanize it and make it universal, so to speak, that I think is what has made it powerful. Because otherwise people would look at singular cases and be like, oh, that's a that community problem, or that's a that poverty problem, or that's a XYZ. Actually, it's not. This is a widespread problem across young boys in this nation, in many, many nations. So yeah, I agree with you. It's just a shame that we don't have the infrastructure to be doing it ourselves, really.
You have to be deluded on a kind of weapons grade level if you think that misogyny is the preserve of one specific culture or a specific community. And part of the problem, I think, that we're having in terms of actually having meaningful conversations about misogyny is that bad faith actors are dragging us into conversations about this being a cultural thing and preventing us from having an actual conversation about the fact that the problem with all of this is a male problem. It's a crisis of masculinity. And one of the solutions that's being floated this week is the idea of setting up a minister for men. Do you think that that is a good idea?
I mean, just the way it sounds obviously sounds quite terrible. And I think it is worth noting that when it was put to Starmer on Five Live, he said he didn't think a minister for men was necessarily the answer. But I do think there does need to be some political intervention. I am slightly annoyed by the fact that this television show, and also just in general, we know the names of the agitators online. One of them is Andrew Tate, you know, another one is Joe Rogan. We know their names, and yet they're just walking around free. And so you have these conversations that kind of rankle me, where you'll hear politicians saying, well, something does need to be done. What could it possibly be? We'll do a task force. We'll get a new government department. And you think, you know what needs to be done. You need to have the algorithms being more transparent, so we can be sure they're not sending harmful content to vulnerable people, to young people, and potentially some of the people who are grifting in this, they need to be punished, you know, at least pulled off the air at the very least. Come on, like, do we need a whole task force for this? I've got an idea. Should I just write to Keir Starmer? Dear Keir, I've got some ideas for you.
Well, I think also there has to be some accountability for the social media companies, because this is part of the issue here, is that we have these huge organizations that operate in every country, but somehow are governed by the laws of none, and that have no responsibility legally as publishers, even though that is absolutely what they are. And some of the things that they are publishing and distributing are actively inciting violence within our communities. Now, if a newspaper was doing that, and we can get into conversations about whether newspapers are responsible for that, but at the very least, newspapers have some regulation applied to them about what they can and can't publish. I think also a good thing that the Labour Party have definitely done is invest in mental health support in schools.
Yes.
But as one of our listeners, Elliot, has pointed out to us this week, the investment in youth centres isn't being considered as part of the solution to youth unemployment. We know that the infrastructure of youth centres collapsed in this country over the last decade and was one of the kind of first key casualties of austerity. And we really, really need to look at reigniting some of that infrastructure to start having places where young people feel that it's safe for them to go, to have actual conversations and start platforming some of the discussions that need to be had on this issue. We talked to Matt Shea on the show, which is an episode you can go back to listen to that's really worth doing, about Andrew Tate and the kind of cult that surrounds him. And, you know, my problem has always been, since I was a young man, I've heard this idea that young men can be very easily radicalized and we need to be very careful about young men being radicalized. But the young men that radicalization is being aimed at are young men that look like me and exclusively young men that look like me. My whole entire life since I was a young man, and now, even as I reflect on that time, as a very, very old man, there has been a long, protracted conversation about the radicalization of black and brown men. That's a conversation that we have. We have no scope in our hearts to have a conversation that white men could also be radicalized. And again, it returns to the same point that if you perceive misogyny to be a cultural problem rather than a problem of masculinity and a male problem, you're never going to get anywhere with these conversations. Whereas actually what we need to realize is that young men are vulnerable and susceptible to radicalization, and into that void that has been left by the decimation of so many different social structures that previously acted as a safety net, people like Andrew Tate have stepped into that void.
I get really upset because I have this moment where I'm like, how many young girls have to die? Like, genuinely, what is the number? What is the number before it's everyone is like, okay, right, fuck the big tech, just fuck them, and, you know, fuck the fiscal rules. This is a crisis. We need to protect these young. I don't know why that hasn't come and when it will come. It really genuinely rankles me. And I know, and in a way you sort of think, oh, maybe this is something that exists outside of politics, but it doesn't. It's a pure politics story. So, you know, I was talking about some of the posts I saw talking about like the culture warness of it, and one of them was saying, it was from Toby Young, if you're interested.
There has never been a point where I have ever thought or said out loud the words, I am interested in Toby Young.
Okay, I'm sorry to bring this to you. Yeah. But he posited his, I would say, crackpot theory that this whole endeavour of making this TV show was propaganda to push forward a censorship agenda, you know, presumably to please the wokes again. And I just thought, oh my God, I mean, do these people have no shame? Like, actual young girls have died.
Oh, I think the question you asked there, that's the key question, is do these people have no shame? No, they don't have shame. All of them were born with a terrible disease that makes them entirely immune to the ability to feel shame. And that's the real discussion we should be talking about.
It's real discussion.
No one is talking about congenital shamelessness disorder, CSD. No one is talking about it. And we need to be talking about it. Because everyone with CSD, there is a 100% take-up rate in people born with CSD and people who have stupid opinions that they're paid for in the press.
All right. I'm glad we solved it, Nish.
And that's it. Thanks so much for listening to Podsave the UK. A reminder that this is the last week to send in your questions for our upcoming mailbag special. So if you've got a burning question, do drop us a line at psuk@reducedlistening.co.uk.
And don't forget to follow @PodsaveTheUK on Instagram, TikTok and Twitter. We're also on Blue Sky now too. So follow us at podsavetheuk.crooked.com. And if you want more of us, make sure you subscribe to our YouTube channel.
PodSave the UK is a Reduced Listening production for Crooked Media.
Thanks to producer Mae Robson and assistant producer and editor Nada Smiljanic.
Our theme music is by Vasilis Fotopoulos.
The executive producers are Louise Cotton, Madeline Herringer and Katie Long, with additional support from Ari Schwartz.
And remember to hit subscribe for new shows on Thursdays on Amazon, Spotify or Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.